going to call the House Judiciary Committee to order. The sub has already gone through House Bill 2245 and 2261. Carrier for 2245 is Representative Garrard. I know you're an expert after listening to this. Do you want to talk to us about it, or would you like to have our legal counsel help us?
Oh, I think this one's pretty easy, Mr. Chair. Basically, 2245 allows legislative counsel to change a geographic reference in statute if the Oregon Geographic Names Board and the United States Board on Geographic Names has approved the name change. Committee members, this is basically in reference to the word squaw, and gives our legislative counsel, it simplifies what is a rather complicated process for them to simply make reference and change to a name that's already pre-approved. This bill had a minimum of discussion and was unanimously passed out of the subcommittee. So we recommend that you pass it out of full committee.
Okay, any committee members have any questions or discussion on the bill? Okay, Representative Garrard, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move Measure 2245 be approved and move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard, move House Bill 2245 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any other further questions?
He's moving it to the floor.
Floor, excuse me, with a due pass recommendation. Okay, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Okay, Representative Garrard, you want to carry that?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next on the agenda is House Bill 2261. I think we'll have Mr. Henderson come up and talk to us a little bit about that so we've all got the information.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. I'd asked today if I'd be able to have an opportunity to come up and talk about one little piece of the process that I sometimes think get a little short shrift in the training sessions that go on during the building, during the initial days of session. I'm sure all of you are probably bored to death of the how a bill becomes a law, especially those of you who have been here for a while. You know how a bill becomes a law. But one of the things that doesn't get explained very often is the process that occurs after a bill becomes a law, after it's been enrolled, been signed by the two presiding officers, been approved by the governor, and then moved on. And what happens to it, and this does lead up eventually to 2261. It's going to take me a little bit, but I'll try to make it quick. What happens to it is it goes to the Secretary of State, who assigns it a chapter number. And that is a chapter number of what is called the Oregon laws. Eventually, all of those laws will be printed in a bound volume, and I bought a copy of last session, the Oregon laws from 2003, last session. This is volume 3 of them. We had 3 volumes last time, and as usual, it has been the case for the last, probably 5 or 10 sessions. We passed about 800 laws. Usually we pass somewhere between 800 and 1,000 laws, up to maybe 1,100, I think, was the high on how many laws are passed. And if you look at the Oregon laws, if you open up the volume and look through, what you're going to find are all the bills that you considered and passed. And what you're going to find is that they do one of three things. They either create a new section, a new statute, they amend an existing statute, one that's already on the books, or it repeals an existing statute. It's the only three things that you can do in one of your laws. Create a new section, amend one, or repeal one. So having done that, you have a volume here that shows how you changed the law from the previous set of laws that as they were last in effect. When the first legislature met in Oregon in like 1859, if I'm not mistaken, 61, I'm not quite sure when the first one was, all they did was enact new sections. There were no sections that needed to be amended because everything was new. They enacted a set of statutes that said, here's a bunch of new sections that are going to be the laws that will govern us here in Oregon as a state. Of course, then the next session they came back and the first thing they did is they thought twice about some of those and amended some of them. Now at that time, that's all they did. They published these a set of things that showed how they amended them. They came back 2 years later and they did the same thing, and they came back 2 years later and they did the same thing. And what happened was is that if you wanted to know what the state law was in the state of Oregon, say five sessions after the first legislative assembly, you needed to have all five sets of laws, because you need to know what the first one looked like, and then you need to know how each successive body amended the previous session's work. So you had to look through literally and see how each one was amended. Well, that's pretty awkward and obviously couldn't go on very long, so at a certain point there was a codification. What a codification is to say, well, let's find out where we're at right now on all the statutes. Let's go look at what the first legislature did and all subsequent legislatures did and put together a set of statutes that says, here's where it's at right now, showing all the amendments that have been made to those first statutes. And so we had our first codification. And we've had three or four different codifications over, maybe more than that, since 1859. The most recent one, of course, the one we're all familiar with is this one, the Oregon Revised Statutes. And what the Oregon Revised Statutes does, when you get the 2003 edition, says, okay, here's where the statutory law of the state of Oregon is as of the time of publication of this volume, showing all changes that have been made by all previous legislatures. So you've got the Oregon laws, the bills you passed showing the changes. But then our office, and this is where we come in, take and incorporate into the previous set of statutes that have been codified and issued as Oregon Revised Statutes. So after you finish this session, there will be another set of Oregon laws, three volumes almost for sure, that will show a bunch of changes to statutes. Our office will take those after you have left, and it usually takes us until December or January after you leave. So it'll be the end of this year, beginning of next. At some point, we will issue a 2005 Oregon Revised Statutes in which we will have gone through and editorially taken what you have done and inserted them into the statutes as they stood in 2003. So it's a rolling process. Every 2 years, we update it. We go ahead and incorporate all of the changes you've made. We have certain editorial authority in doing this process. For instance, many people, when they come in and ask for a draft, say, gee, you know, I'd like this new section that I'm drafting here to be ORS 35.255. And we'll say, well, that's nice, but actually we do that as part of the editing process. After you've enacted Section 2, we will editorially give it a number. And we will decide where it fits. Sometimes the law will tell us that you pass. We'll say, we want to add this section to this chapter or to this series, and it will tell us that's a law. We have to do that, and we do that. But I don't want to get into the complications of that, because that is really complicated. The other thing we do editorially is we write the lead lines. If you go through the ORS and you find a statute and you say, well, here's 19260, that's the number we assign to it, and it says filing by mail right thereafter, a kind of a description of what's going on in the statute. Our office writes that lead line. So sometimes people come and say, gee, I'd like to draft a section, and I want you to put a lead line on it, a thing up in front of it, just like we got in ORS that says it does this. And we'll say, well, that's nice, but that's part of what we do under our editorial authority in describing what it is, the statutes. And that's important, because if you enacted, if these were part of the law, if the number was the part of the law, if the lead line was part of the law, in order to change it, we'd need another law. In other words, we could never change the numberings in it without coming back to you with a huge bill that would make our present revisor's bill dwarf by comparison, that would have to basically change all the numbers that we thought we need to do in order to put the statutes together and to put the codification together. In the process of editing the ORS and taking the statutes you've passed, the laws you've passed, and turning them into the codification, we do a lot of stuff. And one of the things we do is, at one point, the entire ORS gets read by the attorneys in our office, starting chapter by chapter. It's not what you would call a thrilling job, but it's an important job, because what we're doing for is we're looking for problems. We're looking for things that need to be noted, that perhaps can be fixed by way of something like the revisor's bill, which is totally non-substantive, where we try to say this one's safe, we don't have to worry, this should not change anything substantively, and other problems that are more serious, things that we see that just are ambiguous, true problems that we cannot resolve by the revisor's bill, and we make note of those as well. But a great deal of what you see in 2261 are things that come out of that ongoing process of us reading the statute. Sometimes we spot them when we're drafting a bill, and we say, there's a real problem here. The requester says, this isn't my issue. I don't want to try to do this fix right now because I have other fish to fry. And we will say, that's fine, but we'll make a note for our own office's use that there's a problem here, and that will go into a special file so we can keep track of those issues. So House Bill 2261 is sort of the things we know we can do safely that should not affect what it is that legislature intended to do when they passed that law a long time ago. Beyond that are all the other issues that may get addressed. We actually have some bills that have been introduced this session from our office that are a little more substantive, not things that we think really make a huge change in the law, but that are clear problems, and hopefully our drafters will be able to come up and talk to you about those if your committee takes those up as we go through. This one here should be the one that makes the things that we feel are just beyond our editorial our ability to do things editorially, but that still do need to be done for form and style and other issues. So with that, I'll shut up and be happy to try to answer any questions.
Okay, committee members have any questions? Representative Ackerman?
I thought it might be informative if you would tell us how you reference amendments by looking at the ORS statute. In other words, there's always an annotation or a little behind each statute, and it references us back to this session law. Could you explain how that works and how that could be of value to the committee?
Yeah. When you go into the ORS and you open it up and you find the statute you're looking for, and you say, here's 1926, the one I just talked about, filing by mail, and you say, I wonder what's happened to the statute over its history. When was it enacted, and has it ever been amended? And you can find out from the ORS everything that happened to this statute back to 1953. If you want to go back before 1953, it gets a little trickier, because the ORS, this codification only dates from 1953, and then you're into the other codifications that I talked about. You find out by looking at the very bottom of the statute, where you will find what is called the source note. That's the technical term for what's at the bottom of the statute. For instance, under 19260, the first thing it says is formerly 19.02A. Well, that tells you this statute has been renumbered by us at one time, and if you want to find out the rest of its history, you're going to go have to look under 19.02A. But the next thing it shows is 1999, Chapter 367, Section 6. What that tells me is this statute was amended in 1999. And if I go back to the 1999 Oregon laws and I look at Chapter 367 and I look at Section 6, I will find 19260 and I will find what amendments were made by the 1999 Legislative Assembly to this section. So that's how you, that's your first step whenever you're doing legislative research on a statute. You want to know how it got to look the way it is. You go to the source note, and from the source notes, you can go to the Oregon laws and find what it is that was done. And on some of them, the first thing you're going to find when you look at it is, for instance, 19315. The first reference underneath in the source note is 1997, Chapter 172, Section 2. What that tells me is that this law was enacted in 1997, Chapter 172. So it will tell me this is the source of this one. It does not predate 1953. If it predates 1953, that is not, you won't find that source down there. So that's how source notes work. That's kind of basic legislative research on how statutes got to look the way they are.
Follow-up? I have a follow-up. As long as you're here, take advantage of your skills for us. Could you explain what the annotations are, both for the statutes and the Constitution, where they're found and how they're compiled?
The annotations, you're referring to the case notes on the statutes that show the cases interpreting the statutes. We, as part of the process, also prepare what's called annotations of the statutes, and those are basically, we have one person who is devoted half-time basically to reading the cases that are issued by the courts to find references to statutes enacted by the legislature. And as they find those references, if they are a significant reference, if they interpret it somehow or make some significant reference to it, a short case note is written that says, here's what this case did, said about this statute. It is then published in a volume that comes with the ORS, comes with the Oregon Revised Statutes, and I'm working from memory here, I think it's volume 16, I'm not quite sure, but you will find an annotations volume. So if you want to know if there are interesting case interpretations or something that the court has said about that statute, you can turn to the annotations volume, look underneath the statutory reference, say you're looking under 19315, and you will see if we have found cases that have interpreted that, and you can actually go look at the court cases to determine what they've said. So,
thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
I noticed a lot of the changes in this bill, 2261, are just changing which to that. But there are some other places where there's quite substantial bolding in here, like, for instance, Section 137. Well, this one's not a real substantial one, but it stands out to me. Carport.
Section 137.
3 and Section 137. Where it makes a definition of carport, for instance, is this the only place where carport is defined in all of the statutes, or is this, where does this come from? It seems a little bit more than just changing a word to something else.
Now, one of the things we do in the revisers still, excuse me,
page 116,
Chair,
sorry.
Krieger, Representative Thatcher. One of the things we do is provide a note that at the end of each of these sections to try to explain as best we can what we did and why. At the end of this one, you're going to find that the note indicates that what the change here does is moves definition of carport to appropriate chapter in subsection 3. And then it says, see section 313, amending 446.003. So this is not a new definition that we wrote. This is one that was moved from another section to a place that was a more appropriate place for it.
Okay, changes the doctor here because it's consistent.
Any further questions? Representative McCullough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the subcommittee, you referenced that there are some changes that do not require a statutory change, and I think it might be helpful to the committee to understand that distinction. That is it when a word is changed, you can change the, say, the numbering? What's the sort of borderline between that which you can do editorial without a legislative enactment and what we have to do?
Chair Krieger, Vice Chair McPherson, the editorial authority of the Legislative Council is found in the preface to the ORS, and it does give a fairly comprehensive listing of what it is we can do. And I think maybe the best example of the type of thing that we can do without without a change, without a law, without coming to you with a bill to make changes. For instance, on renumbering subsections. As you know, any given section of the ORS may be amended several times during session because it shows up in three or four different bills and people are amending it for different reasons. And we have a process to track those as they go through to make sure that what they do don't conflict substantively. In other words, you don't want to have one law going through that says that the language in one subsection is going to say may and one other bill going through saying that the new language will say shall. That would be a big problem. So we try to ferret those things out as we go through. But say there's a bill that comes through that creates two new subsections too. Well, we could do a conflict, what we call a conflict amendment at that point to say, well, if this one passes, that one passes. That's pretty complicated. We have authority, if we have two new subsections, two, to make one of them subsection three. That's a good example of the extent of our editorial authority as we go through. Not extensive. It is not great. It is things like that where it's very clear. Now, if there was some legal significance to making one, two, or three, because there's another statute that talked about subsection two, we would not be able to do that because with subsection two. But there, if there is no such conflict, we would have authority to do the renumbering necessary to make them fit together. And beyond that, you know, most of our editorial authority relates to things that I've already discussed, things like the numbering, the lead lines, the arrangement, how they fit together in the statutes, where they get placed. We have editorial over that, editorial authority with that. But if it requires a change to a word, other than something that we can say it was our mistake, for instance, if we show that, in fact, what you enacted was different than what we show in the ORS, if we go back and we discover that a word was different in the law that you enacted versus the way it appears now in the ORS, we have authority to make the ORS look like what the statute said it should have been. That we've always have authority to, and we should not have to come back to the legislature to do what they've already done. And so we do a correction to the statutes for that editorially. So that gives you some idea of the type of editorial authority we have.
Any further?
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I noticed that a lot of the changes reflect what appear to be sort of stylistic preferences, you know, things like shall seems to be in disfavor, seems to be that must is the appropriate word in some cases, where seems to be in disfavor as opposed to when, such seems to be in disrepute. How are those decisions on purely sort of stylistic choice, how are they decided, and do they evolve over time?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, as you know, the shall, may, must controversy has been in this building for a long time, and it's always an awkward one for our office. It's been developed primarily through our internal process of determining the best way to write statutes in the clearest fashion. And you can find our decisions about that in two places. One is the form and style manual that's adopted by each body. We prepare it and it's adopted that shows the minimum requirements for how we have to write a bill to make it form and style correct. The other thing is our drafting manual, which includes a lot more than the form and style manual, that shows all the rules that we follow and have developed over the years for deciding how the best way it is to write things. And you can find that on the internet at our website if you're really desperate to get to sleep some night, you know, and you can pull it up. It does tell you quite a bit of interesting things about constitutional questions, for instance, though, that are also discussed in there. But just as an example, the shall may thing is a good example. There are lots and lots of statutes that are out there where they say that a person shall not do something. And the trouble with that is that standard drafting practice throughout the United States, not just here in Oregon, but throughout the United States, is to use shall in a very special way. Shall is used to command a person to do something, to create an obligation in that person to do something. Shall not sounds, has a nice biblical ring to it. I mean, the Ten Commandments really, you know, really do hold sway here to a large degree. And people like to see it. They say, by George, you say shall not. It's like, if you don't, you know, lightning may strike. But the trouble with it is that what you're really saying usually when you say shall not is you're removing discretion in that person to do something. And the preferred way to do that is to negate the authority. And you do that by saying you may not. And so we have come up with a standard practice to try to make it clear, shall is does this, may not removes discretion. Must is interesting because it usually comes it's frequent in procedural type statutes where you say a noticed must have something in it or else it's not valid. Must is usually in a passive voice sentence with talking about some procedural aspect, and that's where you'll see it. Usually you will not see a person must do something because a person shall do something. That's the use of the word. And this is something that's going on not just here in Oregon, but I think you'll find it in several other states. It's a boring technical thing, but it always creates problems, it seems like, as someone says, well, why did you change me to shall in my draft? And usually it's because we're making it consistent with those policies about the use of terminology.
Dave, my grandchildren know both what shall not and may not mean when I tell them. You know? I want to move along here for just a minute, committee members. We got another issue coming up. Scott Gallant, will you come up? And Dave, would you remain for just a minute, please?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association.
Tell us what you found. It's on 216 and 217 of the bill. It has to do with definition of physician.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure that all of you have rifled through this in great detail. And Section 288 actually deals with a section of law that was adopted a number of years ago at the, I believe, the introduction of the pediatric specialty societies of Oregon. We supported the legislation a number of years ago. It has to do with someone unfortunately leaving a child at a facility as defined in the law and their authorized facilities that ultimately the child gets adopted. And the statute in the clarification, and I'm not sure why the change was made, but nevertheless, there is reference to a doctor in on line 45, page 216, and a couple of times in lines 5 and 8. And because of the inconsistency later on, further down in section 7, which begins on line 25 through 31 of page 217. They chose to change the reference to physician to doctor's office and redefine in changing the definition of physician to doctor means a person licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners, et cetera, et cetera. At least in my experience of referencing physicians licensed under medical doctors, doctors of osteopathy, those who do medicine and surgery, have always been referenced as physicians. And so even though this technical change, I think from a drafting perspective, is technically correct from legislative counsel's perspective, I believe it would be inconsistent with almost every other statute that refers to a physician licensed under the Board of Medical Examiners who practices surgery, et cetera. So I'm just raising the issue that I think while this may, within this section, create a consistency, it creates a larger inconsistency with most other statutes that refer to physicians licensed under the BME.
Mr. Henderson, can you elaborate your position or concern? Or
I don't pretend to know every single section in this bill, but I can look at this section and see where the problem was, and that is that The statute talks about doctors in the substantive sections. It talks about you can leave an infant in the physical custody of an agent, employee, doctor, or other medical professional. On the other hand, when you come down to look at the definitions, you have a definition of physician, and physician, it appears, isn't used in the statute. And hence, obvious problem, you have a defined term that's not used, but you have references to doctor, and I'm sure that the drafter looking at that said that really, that the definition was meant to refer to the doctor that the substantive law applied in. So when they went to make the change here for the revisers bill, they conformed the definition to what the substantive thing, substantive law talked about, doctors, as opposed to making a decision to change the substantive provisions to be consistent with physician. You'd have to go through and delete doctor and insert physician is what you would do. So obviously a problem with the statute. Just a question of how the best way it is to fix it.
And Mr. Chairman, I would argue that the definition in the statute was intentional, that they were in fact referencing physicians who practice medicine and surgery. And so there I understand the technical choice that one would make, but I actually would suggest that it would be more consistent with the intent of the statute to change the three references to doctor to physician, because again the definition was specific, particularly in regard to authorized facilities, and then provided a specific definition of what physician meant.
Committee members, any questions? Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, I want to take that back to Dave Hendricks again, the suggestion from Mr. Gallant because it precedes the phrase or other medical professional, it's not intended to be limiting. In fact, either way, it's probably picked up by the broader reference that just follows it. So it would look to me as though the issue would be resolved by doing just as Mr. Gallant suggests, and that is replacing doctor with physician in each of those sections, 418.017.1, 3, and 4. I realize we're all a little reluctant to try and start fussing on the fly here with it, but I'm just wondering if we can tell enough about this to be able to fix on what the resolution should be.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I think, again, without knowing the full history of this, you know, I'd be more comfortable to hear from the drafter. It appears to me that either fix, just on my quick glance, that either way would have resolved the problem, and I'm not sure that it makes, you know, the doctor has the same definition that physician has. I think you get to the same place. It's a question about whether you prefer to use doctor versus physicians in the statutes is what it comes down to, seems to me.
Committee members, any further thing? Either one of you have anything else? Mr. Taylor?
Members of the committee, I went to the provisions under the Board of Medical Examiners. A physician means any person holding a degree of doctor of medicine or doctor of osteopathy. So the same terms seem to be somewhat interchangeable.
Again, Mr. Chairman, I think at least in the drafting that I've been involved in, and I know it's not a lot of experience, but a little experience, we've tried to be consistent in how we reference in other statutes, and I cannot ever recall using doctor and then defining it the way this has been done. So, again, I think in a consistency for other statutes, I would opt for Representative McPherson's option just to be consistent.
I think what we're going to do is I'm going to ask the two of you to get together and rather than move the bill today, see if you can get the wording right and see that this doesn't have some other ramification we don't understand. Right. Committee members, do you have anything further? The criminal subcommittee is going to meet at 8:30 a.m. tomorrow, and you've got two bills. Might take a quick glance at them.
Mr. Tedder, do you have anything?
Chairman, as a committee, on Wednesday, Dave Hendricks, we will have an overview hearing before the civil subcommittee on our tort system in Oregon. And if any of the civil, us criminal law members would like to attend and have the time, it would be worthwhile and beneficial for them to do so.
And that's what time again?
That will start at 8:30 on Wednesday morning for the next meeting of the civil law committee. We're going to be doing, through the first couple of months, overview and basic information on, for example, constitutional law, interpretation of statutes, our tort system, because these are all issues in specific bills that the committee will be dealing with during session.
Okay, then we're adjourned for the day. Thank you.